Today we welcome architects as well as theologians and students and faculty, pastors and visitors and friends. Today we will be hearing the Cook Lecture. The Cook Lecture on Art and Architecture was funded by Ralph and Roberta Cook in honor of Ralph's father, an architect. The purpose of the program is to bring together present and future leaders of the church and professionals in the practice of architecture. The Cook Lecture is one of the special lectures in the sense that it both functions as a lecture and on alternate years we offer a class so that we can have a more extended period of time of studying art and architecture. I have invited Professor Lee Barrett, our professor of theology, to introduce our speaker. Lee is the person who teaches the art and architecture and theology course, and he is also a classmate of David and a good friend. So let's welcome Lee Barrett.
It's my pleasure to introduce as our Cook lecturer an old friend, Dr. David Gowans. David and I have been discussing theological matters since about 1974, and I've always been impressed by the fact that David seemed to actually understand the books by Hegel, Schelling, and Schleiermacher that we were reading. David holds Master of Theology, Master of Sacred Theology, and doctoral degrees from Yale University. I can't understand staying at one institution that long. It's not right. And is currently Associate Professor of Theology and soon to be Associate Dean at Bright Divinity School at Texas Christian University, an institution of the Disciples of Christ. David himself, however, is a sort of Presbyterian missionary to that only marginally reformed group. But David was not always Presbyterian. He was reared in the Reformed Church of America, the Dutch cousin of the German Reformed Church. So he, like many of the folks here, has deep roots in the piety of the Heidelberg Catechism. Now you may be asking yourself, so what does he know about art, architecture, aesthetics? After all, his main research interest seems to be Søren Kierkegaard, who designed no worship spaces and painted no icons. The notion of a Kierkegaardian worship space, though, is intriguing. And incidentally, David has written two of the best books ever on Kierkegaard. But lately, his focus has shifted to the intersection of aesthetics and Reformed theology, to combat the stereotype that Reformed folks are a bunch of artistic barbarians whose idea of beauty is stripped-down, utilitarian brick boxes, sort of like the library. To salvage the reputation of the Reformed tradition and to help ensure that the library never happens again, David is working on a book on Reformed aesthetics entitled To Enjoy God Forever. And in the current edition of the journal Doxology, he has an article on Mozart, theology, and worship, and a similar article in the fall 2000 edition of the journal Modern Theology. So, in short, he knows what he's talking about, and we are in for a treat.
Thank you. Thank you, and good morning to each of you. I'm so pleased to be with you this morning. Before we get any further, we probably should turn on the lamps for the projectors. We're going to be seeing some slides today. Lee, thank you for that lovely introduction. You've known me so long, I was afraid of what you would say about me. But you were very kind. You were very kind. This year is a great occasion for your institution. It's the 175th anniversary of Lancaster Theological Seminary, and it's the year of the rededication of this chapel, this worship space. So it's a special honor for me that Lancaster Theological Seminary and Dean Prophet invited me to take part in this year-long celebration. You are students, you are faculty, you are alumni, you are friends, and you bring to this place a treasure of memories and associations that I don't have. But what I would hope to do today, contribute today, as a very sympathetic guest, is reflection on your traditions embodied here and on your future. I take as my theme the question in the subtitle of this lecture, and by the way, there were handouts at the back, two of them. Did everyone pick them up on the way in? Everyone have them? Okay, because I include a slide list there as well, so please have those in front of you. I take as my theme the question in the subtitle of this lecture, is there such a thing as Reformed architecture? To which the answer, I can say right up front, is yes and no. Yes, in that there are continuing themes and concerns in much of Reformed architectural expression over the centuries, but no, in that it appears to me that a lot of reflection on what Reformed architecture might mean has, especially in the last few decades, been defined much too narrowly. In fact, this very Gothic Romanesque building and your distinctive chapel worship space would appear to fail the tests of Reformed architecture, at least as it has been defined by many. It would appear to some to be much more Catholic than Reformed. More Catholic than Reformed. My argument will be that the term Reformed architecture, both historically and theologically, needs to be more broadly defined than it has been. My argument, but perhaps I am preaching to the choir this morning, I don't know, is that this so Gothic Romanesque building and its distinctive worship space are also Reformed, both historically and theologically. I thought it might be, well, just plain fun to share with you today, with very briefly, with the help of slides, some of the great variety in the history of Reformed architectural tradition going back to the Reformation. Now, I'm going to be sketching this in very broad strokes, given our limited time, but sometimes the broad strokes are the most helpful. In addition to the slides, I also want to include this chapel that surrounds us today. And then I want to conclude with a few thoughts about how this chapel can contribute to thinking about the direction, the future direction of Reformed architecture and worship space, not just for this tradition, but more broadly for the Reformed family. Thus, the title of this talk, From Zurich to Lancaster and Beyond. Let's look at the Reformation. The place is Zurich in the year 1524, and the reformer is Huldrych Zwingli, who is embodied in one of your stained glass windows in this chapel. Zwingli is a fascinating person. He's a humanist, a person trained in the arts, a musician especially, and yet a reformer who stripped the Grossmünster Church in Zurich of its art and its trappings. He whitewashed the interior, but who also rejected the old Roman liturgy and even eliminated all choral and instrumental music from the cathedral's worship. Now, Zwingli, as I've said, was no Rube or Bumpkin. He was a lover of music in particular, but in stripping the altars in Zurich, in removing the church's organs, he proceeded from a belief that in Scripture, God has not commanded musical worship, and indeed God outrightly forbids graven images. They must go. Now, at first sight, we might cringe at that iconoclasm, which has been so much a part of the Reformed tradition, and I cringe at a lot of it too. But when you look at the context within which Zwingli was operating, one can find much with which to sympathize in his stripping of the altars. For the Grossmünster Cathedral contained some, shall I say, quaint relics. There was an Easter grave. Pilgrims descended to a chapel containing a wooden sepulcher under a canopy supported by pillars of brilliantly painted wood. Now, surrounding the sepulcher were large wooden statues of Mary Magdalene and Mary and St. John. While in the sepulcher, wrapped in a white coverlet with silken tassels, was laid a wooden replica of the body of Christ, which was removed from the grave on Easter Sunday. Think of the visual spectacle of that. There it is before Easter. Then it is removed. In Grossmünster II on Palm Sunday, the practice arose of drawing down the nave of the great cathedral, a wooden donkey bearing a statue of Christ. And best of all, on Ascension Sunday, a huge image of Christ was slowly raised up from the floor of the choir until it disappeared from the people's sight through a hole in the vaulting contrived especially for the purpose. Art historian Margaret Miles has said, what we see in Grossmünster before Zwingli is the engagement of vision, complete and total. And here is what the Grossmünster looks like after Zwingli. Right slide, please, Dan. How different. How different a space. The change was shocking to some. It was a real desecration. One pious visitor who had just returned from pilgrimages to Compostela in Spain and the Holy Land came from Schaffhausen to Zurich and reported that there was nothing at all inside, and it was hideous. It was hideous. But Zwingli himself exclaimed triumphantly that in Zurich we have churches which are positively luminous. The walls are beautifully white. Beautifully white. Important liturgical changes were made, too. The stone altar was torn down. A pulpit was placed atop the center of the rood screen, separating the nave from the chancel. And here you see the present pulpit to the left. And the Lord's Supper was served on wooden plates and cups. So what was going on here? There is no separate sacred space in the Grossmünster anymore. It is rather one entire space in which the people gather. The house of God has become a house of the people. The congregation is included in the worship, and the focus so clearly is on the preaching of the word. We move from a visual culture to an auditory culture in the Grossmünster. Also, notice this in Zurich, how often was communion celebrated under Zwingli? Very rarely. Four times a year became the practice. Frequent preaching, but very infrequent communion. Slide, Dan, please. When we move to Geneva, we come to John Calvin, and John Calvin executes a similar program of stripping of the altars. I don't have a slide of the Church of Saint-Pierre in Geneva where Calvin preached, but I can describe for you very easily the changes that he made. Think of it in terms of this space here. The choir stalls were removed at Saint-Pierre, along with the stone altar, and the pulpit was moved from a central nave pillar, which would be over there, to a position, a pillar, which would be farther up at the point where the transept went across the nave. Now, this gave an open space, and that was the point. You have the pulpit placed in the center of the open space. People can sit in the nave and sit in the transept, but they are gathered around the pulpit. And when the Lord's Supper was served, the table was moved into the center of that crossing so that the people were all around it. Preaching of the word, Lord's Supper, a people's space, conducted in the midst of the worshipers so that all had access. Well, what do we make of all this iconoclasm that's going on in the Reformed churches and the Reformation? It's very tempting, I think, for us to say this is simply hatred of art. It's a reaction against the visual, especially if you have interest in the visual arts. But I think there's another way of looking at it, and let me look at, no, Dan, you have this slide. Please hit it again. This is the church, and it's on the slide list, of St. Bravo in Haarlem in the Netherlands after cleaning in a painting from the 17th century. It is often said that the Reformed lack an interest in aesthetics. But recall, if you will, Zwingli's exclamation, our church is now luminously white. Here, too, in St. Bravo, there is, I suggest, a powerful aesthetic sensibility at work. No images, no clutter, but clean white lines, spaces filled with light. There is beauty in St. Bravo. Indeed, when we remember that the Gothic style under Abbot Suger centuries before began as a theology of light, Suger wanted to fill the Gothic interior with light through stained glass, but it was oriented to light. We can see that this whitewashing of this Gothic space is not entirely out of keeping with the Gothic spirit. Here too in St. Bravo, the focus is on the Word of God, the auditory rather than the visual. Worship is centered primarily around preaching and secondarily around the Eucharistic ritual. Now, it's often the case that when the Reformed took over churches, they did not remodel extensively. And they did not build a lot of churches either. Oftentimes, they were too poor to engage in an architectural program. And so they just didn't have the means to do it. They made adaptations in the space that they were given. But there are also instances where Protestants did build churches, and it's fascinating to see some of the developments, how this Reformed faith took form as they did build some architectural space. And this takes us to Huguenot France, Reformed Protestant France. The Huguenot minority experimented in worship space, the shape of the interior structure of their worship spaces. They called their churches temples, and they were calling upon an Old Testament image there, the temple of the Old Testament. Temple designated the physical structure, whereas the word church indicated the community that gathered in the temple. Three temples were built in Lyon in 1554. They were destroyed only 3 years later by opponents of the Reformation. Fortunately, however, there are plans and even paintings of these churches. Dan, slide, please. What you see here is the Temple of Paradise at Lyon in 1554. If you look at the left, you see the plan of it. It's noteworthy for being a centralized plan. It's circular. And the Temple of Lyon is recalling the ancient circular structure for churches from previous generations. If you look at A indicates the pulpit right there, and B indicates the Lord's table. Notice how everything is focused in a circular fashion. Direction is pointed this way from any point in the circular structure. If you look at the right slide, we see a painting of the interior with a balcony around the entire wall, a communion table on the floor in front of the pulpit, and the circular or hexagonal churches were common out of consideration against, again, of auditory ease, the auditory nature of worship. I'm especially pleased that you see there are dogs present in church. My wife and I own three greyhounds, and we are convinced they are creatures of grace and should be baptized. But my pastor will not allow that. Dan, slide, please. Another example of a French Huguenot worship space is the Temple of Charenton, 1623. And you see the plan on the left, and then on the right a plan and a cross section, an engraving of the cross section by Jean Moreau. This was a famous French Huguenot building. It's very large. It's rectangular rather than circular. Large numbers of people can be accommodated to hear the preaching of the word through the use of the two levels, or actually three levels, of balconies on all four sides of the building. So, again, notice the balconies here. All the worship space is oriented around the center pulpit and the table. The Reformed in France, but also in the Netherlands, Switzerland, Scotland, they built churches in rectangles and squares and circles, as well as polygons and ellipses. And again, in all of these spaces, we have no separation of chancel and nave. That's disappeared. All of the focus is on the preaching and hearing of the word. This is space that reflects their understanding of church. Church is a place where the word is preached and the sacraments are celebrated. Well, this is a very, very rapid survey of developments in Europe. We need to move on to America, however. And let's go then to Reformed architectural developments in America. As we move into the 18th century and to the American continent, the Reformed architectural tradition takes different paths, matching different theological and worship emphases as well. Now, part of this is simply adapting to different architectural styles. The Reformed often simply take over whatever current style is on the scene. But this is a somewhat complex story, but for clarity's sake, we can illustrate this development by contrasting the Reformed aesthetic architectural sensibility as it developed in New England, number one, with a later 19th century tradition that has links with your churches and your school's historical traditions. And as you can see on the outline, we might call this A, the simple tradition, and B, Reformed Romanticism and the rediscovery of the liturgy. Let's look first at A, the simple tradition from meeting house to church. Now, when we turn to New England Congregationalism, we turn, of course, to part of your own tradition here in the United Church of Christ. Let's look at, Dan, if you'll go to the blank slide. What we have on the left is the Rocky Hill Meeting House in Amesbury, Massachusetts, built in 1785. Now, the Meeting House is a typical English Reformed church structure that strove to get away from the notion of a church structure. Because they were being persecuted quite often and were alienated from the established state church in England, they strove to have worship space in which there was nothing sacred. Nothing sacred. It's not a house of God, again, it's a house of the church. And this developed into the meeting house concept. This meeting house functioned as a political meeting house as well. Meeting houses often serve dual functions, worship space, but also a place of political meeting. This, too, is a preaching space primarily, but there's a new twist in the history at this point. This is even more emphatically a preaching space in the meeting house concept. And that has to do with the 18th century abandonment of liturgy in the Reformed, again, in reaction against what they perceived to be ill treatment by the Church of England, and with the increasing influence of separatist notions, think of the Puritans and the Pilgrims. The result was there was a virtually complete reaction of the British and American Reformed in the 18th century against all forms of worship. What did they drop? Liturgical prayers. The Creed. The Ten Commandments. The Gloria Patri, even the Lord's Prayer, and sometimes even the reading of Scripture. It's a different form of worship. There's a reaction against any formal liturgy. Yet, the worship in the meeting house was intensely spiritual. And one way of understanding the meeting house worship space is that it signals a shift from the public to the private sphere. Whereas churches had enacted communal society by extended liturgical performances, meeting houses housed the inner transformation of individuals by the preached word of God. Much more a focus on the individual. If you've ever attended a Society of Friends meeting, you see that in extreme. No preaching even. Rather, the individuals coming together to seek the inner light. But at the same time, the meeting house is not solely individual. It is a place where people come together. Meeting house has two meanings. It's the meeting together of people in the house of the church, where there is secondarily, or I perhaps should say primarily, a meeting with God vertically, the horizontal and the vertical, again, in a very plain space. What about Pennsylvania? I haven't said anything about Pennsylvania yet. In your region, during the colonial period, there was such incredible religious diversity. Peter W. Williams, in his wonderful book called Houses of God, which I recommend to you, writes that more than in New England and the South, in the Mid-Atlantic, we see intense pluralism that would later characterize the new republic. Williams continues that the Pennsylvania Dutch country of eastern Pennsylvania represents a unique concentration of colonial-era German culture with a built environment ranging from that of the tradition-oriented Amish to the ethnically sectarian Ephrata community. Now, with the encouragement of William Penn, the peace churches, of course, were encouraged to settle in this area. This included Anabaptists, whether the Amish, who built no churches but worshipped in homes, or the Mennonites, who built meeting houses like the one here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. You know, too, Dan's slide, the Brethren, or Dunkards, and the Society of the Solitary that split off from them in 1735 to form the celibate community in the Ephrata cloister. Slide, please, Dan. And what of the Reformed? Here's a very interesting structure. It is the Donegal Presbyterian Church in Franklin County. Here, too, that simple tradition flourishes, as can be seen in this Scots-Irish church, one of the earliest Presbyterian church buildings in the area. It was built in 1732, and in 1958, a wing duplicating the original structure was added, so duplicating the original structure, connected by an enclosed one-story hallway. This, too, functioned obviously as a meeting house as well as a place of worship. It was a focal point for military and political discussions at the beginning of the Revolutionary War and a gathering place for patriots. A white oak, the witness tree, still standing outside the church, was where the Scots-Irish patriots pledged allegiance to the colonists' cause. Okay, thus the meeting house tradition in various incarnations. Here, Mennonite on the left, on the right, a Presbyterian form here in Pennsylvania. What happened very quickly, though, is that the meeting house tradition among the Reformed in this country developed back into a church tradition. And we can see that in the next two slides, please. This is the first church in Hartford, Connecticut. You see the exterior on the left and on the right, the exterior portico with the columns, the Ionic capitals, cornice molding, and on the right, the interior view of the structure. I've put on the reading list a wonderful book that I recommend to you. Paul Corby Finney has a book called Seeing Beyond the Word, Visual Arts and the Calvinist Tradition, which treats the Huguenot tradition I've spoken of, treats this tradition also. It's a wonderful, wonderful volume, and I suggest you look at it and purchase it, if possible, as well. In that volume, there's a wonderful article by Gretchen Townsend Bugeln, which deals with this church, and she makes some very interesting points about it. She says, by the early 19th century, the New England meeting house had completed yet another metamorphosis into the white-painted neoclassical structure that has since become a veritable icon of regional culture. Now, part of this change was stylistic and reflected especially the influence of Christopher Wren and the high-style British churches, but added also, notice the columned portico and porches to the basic Wren model, and also notice that magnificent steeple, an extended steeple, adds great height to the structure. And again, notice, if you see on the right, the Ionic column portico there. Now, what was behind the shift from the meeting house to the church? The author of the article, Gretchen Townsend Bugeln, suggests that what we see is a shift in religious sensibility. A shift in religious sensibility. There is, at this time, and it's 1807 that this church is built, an increased concern with the religion of the heart, an increased interest in aesthetic sensibility and religious feeling reflected in public worship. There is a desire to make the worship space special and not just plain. And so we're moving away from that meeting house concept. There is still simplicity here, but there is also elegance and there is sensibility after the American Revolution. Well, to sum up where we've come thus far, The history of Reformed Church architecture in Europe and in America makes clear there is no one style, but many. But also, contrary to popular views, there is evidence of great aesthetic sensitivity, and I think you can see that in this structure. Donald Davy has written that if we can speak of a Calvinist aesthetic, it is one marked by simplicity and sobriety and order. The Reformed who championed the simple style in any of its incarnations were in many cases as sensitive to aesthetic concerns as well as to the requirements of Reformed worship. Now, part of my argument this morning is that often in the 20th century, when theologians speak of Reformed architecture, what they have in mind is this tradition that we've been looking at thus far this morning. But that's only part of the story, I suggest to you, part of the story of Reformed architecture. And so I want to turn now to a later strand with a different liturgical sensibility, which in the 19th century developed into another style of Reformed architecture and worship space, what I'm calling Reformed Romanticism and the Rediscovery of Liturgy, which is point B on your outline. Now, I'm not telling you anything new when I say that the German Reformed tradition inherited by your institution has a somewhat different history from that of other Reformed groups. One of Lee's and my old professors, Sidney Ahlstrom at Yale, put it this way, that while the German Reformed movement owed much to the Reformation in Switzerland, above all to Zwingli and Bullinger of Zurich, yet in the family of Reformed communions it has a character of its own. The German Reformed in the Palatinate had great proximity to the Lutherans, and the German Reformed movement's response to this proximity was to be mediating, to be mediating. Early on, the pious and the Irenic, the peaceful, and the experiential tone of the 1563 Heidelberg Catechism that was authored by Caspar Olivianus and by Zacharias Ursinus, Dan, slide please, and who are in your windows here in this very chapel, bear witness to this Irenic spirit. I had to memorize large portions of the Heidelberg Catechism as a boy growing up in the Dutch Reformed Church a number of years ago. I know Zacharias Ursinus very well and the Heidelberg by heart. Ahlstrom concludes, the Lutheran liturgical tradition was never completely replaced by the thoroughgoing reforms of Zwingli. Thus, in the Palatinate liturgy of 1563, the same year as the Heidelberg Catechism, there was featured a liturgical order that found its focus in the sermon, but with monthly celebrations of the Eucharist, much closer to what at least John Calvin in Geneva thought to be ideal. Calvin thought you should celebrate the Eucharist weekly, every Lord's Day. And he died saying, our practice in Geneva is deficient. Zwingli, in Zurich, was doing it, what, quarterly? But the German Reformed practiced monthly celebration of the Eucharist. It was much more central to their worship and to their piety. Now, we've seen already that other Reformed bodies had liturgies. The Dutch did, the Scots did, the English did. But in the 18th century, English-influenced churches, there was such a strong reaction against the liturgy, and churches became primarily preaching houses. But what about the German Reformed Church in America? Now, here too, as I understand it, and perhaps you can inform me about this further, there appears to have been great diversity in the 18th and early 19th centuries. The Palatinate liturgy was often used, but with varying degrees of attention. In fact, even in the German Reformed churches, there was often reaction against liturgical worship, mirroring the American experience. An example is the Race Street Reformed Church in Philadelphia, where congregants were fearful of the Lord's Prayer and the Apostles' Creed. Indeed, the sentiment on occasions was so strongly against all forms of formalism that there were periods when the congregation had no part in the service except singing hymns. That was it. That was it. But this brings us to the next part of our story. Central to the developing history of the German Reformed churches, For this rejection of liturgy was soon to change among the German Reformed as well as other church bodies in the early 19th century. And that new acceptance of liturgy affects church architecture as well. Now, part of this story is, if you look under B, 2 points, is the birth of the Gothic Revival style in architecture. But secondly, it also has to do with Merzenberg's reflections on liturgy and architecture. But let's turn to the first point on the Gothic Revival. Slide, please. This is a view of the Green in New Haven, Connecticut. We have 2 views of it. And here we see a beautiful instance of the origins of Gothic Revival in America. For we have 3 churches that were built within 1 year of each other. The church on the right is United Church Congregational, built in 1816. In the center is First Congregational, or Center Church, also built in 1816. But on the left is a Gothic structure. Can you see it? It's a little bit off on both slides, but do you see it? That is a Gothic structure. That is Trinity Episcopal Church, built 1 year later in 1817. Lee Baird and I know these churches very well from our years in New Haven. They are still there. They're still there. It was not, however, until the 1840s that mature Gothic revivalism appeared on the scene of American church architecture. A lot of that had to do with the English Ecclesiastical Society that launched a missionary effort for Gothic revival in this country. That movement was centered in the Protestant Episcopal Church in this country, but a great number of Gothic churches built in the 1840s was obvious public testimony to a new American church style to which other church bodies had to respond. It seemed fresh. It seemed new. And it made the earlier classical styles seem a bit outdated. A bit outdated. And it also championed a more sacramental understanding of worship. The Gothic style also dominated public architecture in the United States. And during the years between Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln was positively irresistible, according to one historian. We can see an example of this in civic architecture right here in Lancaster. Slide, please, Dan. And that is the Lancaster County Jail, built in 1850. Does this structure still stand? Does it? Okay. I wasn't sure if it did or not. I found this photograph in a book on Gothic architecture in America, and I just had to shoot it. This was built by the English-born architect John Haviland, who did a lot of Gothic revival in this country. Although I must confess, it doesn't look Gothic to me. This is very heavy. Gothic is light and airy, isn't it, with pointed arches? This seems to me much more Romanesque in its sensibilities. That brings us, though, to the next point on the outline, and that is Merzenberg on liturgy and architecture. Another manifestation of American religious romanticism. Slide, please. Here are your worthies. Here are your worthies. In the 19th century, it wasn't just the German Reformed Communion, but those segments of the church, Roman Catholic, Episcopal, Lutheran too, that were affected by the Romantic movement. They moved to greater Eucharistic devotion and frequency of communion. John Williamson Nevin on the left and Philip Schaff on your right, 2 of the great lights of your tradition at Merzenberg, standing behind Lancaster, continued that mediating tradition of the Heidelberg Catechism. Nevin polemically attempted to return the German Reformed Communion away from the Charles Finney revivalist movements, away from the anxious bench, away from revivalistic individualism and subjectivism, and away from that Zwinglian memorial understanding of the Eucharist. And Nevin wanted to return the Reformed tradition back to what he was convinced was a more classically Reformed and also Catholic high understanding of the church as the body of Christ and the sacraments as the heart of Reformed worship and piety. Well, you know, I'm sure, about the history of the 30 Years' War in the German Reformed Church, the protracted and often bitter debate on liturgical reform, and I'm not going to rehearse that controversy. But I do want to, for our purposes this morning, make three comments about the German Reformed Mercersburg connection. First point is this: what exactly is Reformed in worship and liturgy? While worship in the Reformed tradition was historically liturgical, this history had been obscured in North America, as we have seen, even among the German Reformed churches. The importance of Nevin and Schaff is to reconnect the German Reformed to your historical and liturgical roots, especially the Palatinate liturgy. Second point is this: what is the role of beauty, in Christian worship and Christian development? It's fascinating to see how extensive was the concern in these times with what today we would call theological aesthetics, that is, the role of beauty in worship, the role of beauty in the formation of Christian persons. And here I'm indebted to Betty Barrett and to Lee Barrett for bringing to my attention some fascinating articles from the Mercersburg Review and the Reformed Quarterly Review, that sort of rival journals, between 1860 and 1891 that deal with aesthetics. And they're asking, what is the place of art? What is the place of imagination? What is the place of beauty in our Christian life and in our worship space and our church architecture? The third point has to do with this question: what are the implications now of returning to liturgy and a concern with beauty? First two points: what are the implications for church architecture? And I can sum up the controversy in one sentence: altar or table? Altar or table? Now, here's where Mercersburg caused much controversy. For Nevin, the Eucharist was a sacrifice, and therefore it was appropriate to speak of the altar. He did not like the central pulpit of his day, and he contended that the pulpit must be ready to resign the whole chancel, if need be, to the altar. See, we have a recovery of chancel and a recovery of altar in Nevin's thought. Well, this infuriated John H.A. Bomberger of the more Zwinglian persuasion in the German Reformed Church, who argued, no altars. What we want to do is hold on to what Bomberger thought was the classic Reformed understanding. That is, not altar, but table. Not altar, but table. There are other indications of architectural interest in the Mercersburg Review. In an article in 1860, there is an argument that goes like this. It's an anonymous article, but it says this: we have an altar, therefore around it we must have a square chancel. A square chancel. And why is that? Because of the centrality of the Incarnation and the presence, the spiritual presence of Christ in the Eucharist, which is on the altar, this needs to be reflected in the church space around it. Therefore, square chancel. Square chancel. On the outline, if we go to point C, Santee Chapel in the Lark Building at Lancaster. What does this old controversy between Nevin and Bomberger have to do with your chapel space in this year of its rededication? Now, according to some, this chapel space would appear entirely at odds with the Reformed tradition. But this chapel and its art are, of course, within the spirit of the Mercersburg branch of your tradition, which strove to be Reformed and evangelical and also Catholic. Now, in examining the heritage of Mercersburg here, I want to do two things. First, consider the Lark Building as itself, and secondly, the chapel. Built in 1893-94, the Lark Academic Building is, as you say on your website, and I would not question your website, the finest example of Romanesque Gothic architecture in Lancaster County today. I didn't see it until last night and this morning, and I tell you, I am impressed. This is a very, very impressive building. Now, Santee Chapel was originally a lecture hall transformed into a chapel in 1925 for the 100th anniversary of the founding of the seminary. Now, architecturally, the building stands in the Richardsonian tradition, named after the man who instigated the next great stage in American architecture, and that's H.H. Richardson. Dan, slide, please. There is a photograph of Richardson in all of his glory, his rotund glory, a very prosperous architect in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. Slide, please. Do you recognize this structure? This is Trinity Church on Copley Square in Boston. Richardson stands behind the Romanesque revival in America, not only in church architecture, but also in public buildings and domestic architecture in this period. Trinity Church was completed in 1877. It's Episcopalian, not Reformed, but it indicates the shape of things to come in American church architecture for lots of denominations for years to come. According to Richardson's own words, the style of the church may be characterized as a free rendering of the French Romanesque, and the central tower recalls the domes of Venice and Constantinople. And the tower becomes not an addition to the building, but the main feature of it. In the slide on your left, you can see also, do you see the marble arch here? That covers the statue of Phillips Brooks, the great rector and preacher at Trinity, and the author of O Little Town of Bethlehem. The statue was sculpted by Augustus St. Gaudens. Let's look at the interior. Now that is the interior of a Romanesque Richardsonian church. Isn't that incredible? Notice the centrality of the altar within. Now that's not a square chancel, is it? That's an apsidal chapel. Now until 1914, there was no altar in the chancel, but a large wooden Lord's table in the center of a semicircular chancel rail in partaking of the Lord's Supper. Notice, too, the pulpit attached to the pier on the left. You see it right there? With that magnificent sounding board above it. And the lectern on the right. The Richardsonian influence on American church architecture was, again, immense. And most important, Richardson established the pattern of split chancel, or usually split chancel, with table or altar in the center, a pulpit on one side and a lectern on the other, which became almost universal. And also, as we will see, became a matter of some consternation to Reformed writers on church architecture in the 20th century. The influence can be seen, for example, of the Romanesque in this variety of it. This is the Philippus Church of the United Church of Christ in Cincinnati, built in 1890. This is Lutheran-influenced, Catholic-influenced, Italianate-influenced. It is a variant on the Romanesque that we see here. This is in Cincinnati's Over the Rhine neighborhood, the German neighborhood. And you can't see it, I'm afraid, but at the top there is not a cross. There is a hand pointing to heaven. A hand pointing to heaven. A lovely touch. Lovely touch. Okay, but now, okay, the background of Richardsonian architecture we can see in the Lark Building. What about this chapel? What about Santee Chapel? This chapel, too, bears witness to the Catholic and evangelical heritage in the Reformed tradition, as stated in the mission statement of your seminary. You have here an altar, a source of controversy in Mercersburg days, to be sure, and even images of the apostles in the wood-carved panels behind the altar, and I'm sorry to obscure them for you this morning. The panels on the altar were added in 1959 and are copies of panels in the Cathedral of Palermo in Sicily. And these magnificent stained glass windows depict the early history of the church. And I cannot fail to comment on the new bas-reliefs that have just been installed in this chapel. These magnificent pieces. What we see in Santee Chapel is not a simple transcript of Mercersburg Romanticism, but a chapel that is certainly within the broad heritage of Mercersburg. For what we see evidenced here is a theologically informed affirmation of the liturgical and sacramental tradition of Mercersburg, even with the presence of an altar. We see here an obvious concern with theological aesthetics, with beauty, with the arts, also consistent with your own tradition. Now, if you turn over the page, I have a third section called Beyond Lancaster. But I see that I've exhausted my time. And I want to leave some time for questions and comments on the history thus far. And so what I might propose to do then, if it's agreeable to you, is to end the lecture here. And perhaps if people are interested in the workshop this afternoon, we can continue the story beyond Lancaster. Is that agreeable? Okay. Good. You want to see the slides? Shall I go on? Okay, I'll go on. Great. Okay, beyond Lancaster. Is there anything beyond Lancaster? Well, where have we come? I've been arguing a very simple point. There is no one style of Reformed architecture. For the Reformed not only adopt many different architectural styles, but if you allow Nevin and Schaff to be within the Reformed tradition, and I do, the Reformed also differ among themselves in their conceptions of word and sacrament, their relationship, and how that reflects in church architecture. Now, what I find very interesting, though, is that I've read a lot of literature lately from the 50s and 60s about what is Reformed architecture. And I find it fascinating to see how narrow those discussions have often been, often excluding the strongly liturgical, sacramental, and Gothic Romanesque features of the Mercersburg tradition. Mercersburg, in short, is dismissed as being more Catholic than legitimately Reformed. Now, we can look at two sides of this narrowing of the definition of Reformed architecture in the 1950s and 60s, for it includes both architectural history and also theological developments. And I have those items listed as A and B on your outline. Architectural modernism is the first point, and B, Reformed modernism in the 50s and 60s. Let's turn to the first point, architectural modernism. Two points need to be made here. First is the decline in the American scene of Gothic and Romanesque architectural styles. Chris Brooks, who has written a history of Victorian church architecture, writes that the problem of the Gothic revival is that it had strong literary, archaeological, and moral streaks to it, but the architectural culture of today is largely visual and functional. Indeed, the Gothic Romanesque style has become a cultural symbol for nostalgia. In another book on Gothic architecture in America, I was surprised to see the decline of Gothic illustrated by this building. And again, is this still standing? Is it? Okay. All right. You know this then. Okay, this is wonderful. This is Dutch Wonderland, built in 1963. In this book on the whole history of Gothic style in America, the final chapter on decline featured this photograph. And they use this photograph to make what they feel to be a very important point, and that is that Gothic oftentimes is invoked today to impart a feeling of a make-believe world, whether in Lancaster or in Disney's Anaheim, or Orlando. Okay. Ah. Second point. Architectural modernism and functionalism replace the Gothic and Romanesque revivals. And in architectural modernism, what is the key phrase? Form follows function. Form follows function. Let's look at some examples of architectural modernism. Dan, please. This is the St. Francis de Sales Church in Muskegon, Michigan, built in 1967. Here is form following function with a vengeance. This is a Roman Catholic church built by Marcel Breuer in 1967. It has 75-foot walls of exposed concrete, unmodulated curved walls. Notice the curved exterior wall here. There is no distracting statue, no decoration except for the cross, and you see the belfry on top. Nothing to obscure that clean, open space. This shows the influence of the modernist Austrian architect Adolf Loos, who believed that, quote, ornamentation is a disease, and a crime that weakened architecture. And Luce wrote in 1908 that lack of ornament is a sign of spiritual strength, and believed that from God's point of view, a church is a machine to live in. And from man's point of view, pardon the non-inclusive language, a machine to pray in. A machine to pray in. Well, I find that stark. I don't know about you. But modernism can also be more delicate. And let's look at another example. This is a fine example of modernism. This is not a Reformed church structure, but this is Eero Saarinen's Kresge Chapel at MIT in Massachusetts, built in 1953. The exterior shot on the left and the interior. I'm sorry, Dan. Sorry, Dan. Blank. Good. go one more, please. And I will go one more also. Thank you. And here's the interior. This is much more delicate than the St. Francis de Sales Church. The chapel, despite its deliberate lack of representational or Christian images, still suggests something powerful about divine transcendence. The baldacchino, if you will, that modernist baldacchino above the table, suggests the descent of the Holy Spirit or the giving of manna from heaven. And I cannot but help think of this as the eye of God. That is my own imagination, I'm sure, but take it or leave it. But here is modernism. Form follows function. This is wonderful space. What goes on here? Preaching. Eucharist. It's very, very clear. But what about the influence of modernism in a Reformed church? A good example of modernism in the service of Reformed church architecture can be seen in a very small Dutch Reformed church in the Netherlands, presented in Donald J. Brugink and Carl H. Dropper's fine book, Christ in Architecture, which I regret is out of print. Slide, please, Dan. Here, too, is a modernist church. This is the Ark. It's a church in the suburbs of Amsterdam. The sanctuary stands at the center of the building, surrounded by community space, open offices. It is a place of person-to-person contact, but at the center, you go into the sanctuary and you find this discrete worship space. This is plain, but I find it pleasing. I don't know how you react to it. It's plain, but also very pleasing. We see here, I think, the simple tradition of Reformed architecture in modernist dress. There's an aesthetic of simplicity here that allows concentration. There is no distraction of attention. Pulpit, font, and table are at the center of the eye's view. Here, in a very good sense, I think form does follow function. This is functional Reformed church architecture that communicates the importance of word and baptism and Eucharist. Notice the placing of the baptismal font. When you come into the sanctuary, you go right past the baptismal font. Every time you go to church, you are reminded of your baptism. It is visually central, visually central. Your eye then follows to the pulpit and then to the table, which here is clearly, isn't it, a table rather than an altar. I want to go on to point B on the outline, Reformed modernism in the 50s and 60s. Now, there are architectural developments, I've said, that lead to Reformed modernism, but also there is a kind of ideology of Reformed architecture that is expressed in the 50s and 60s. That I think really narrow the definition of Reformed architecture. Many Reformed writers in the 50s and 60s were so worried about the Richardsonian split chancel, were so worried about continuing Anglo-Gothic understanding of worship, that they fixed upon architectural modernism as a godsend and the best possible heir of the simple tradition. When we look at writings on Reformed architecture in the 50s and 60s, we read a very striking rejection of the Romantic tradition. One writer says, for example, Protestant architecture, writing in 1965, somewhat bewildered, tried to be religious by going in for neo-Gothic imitations. So too, Donald Brugink and Karl Droppers, writing also in 65, complained that the National Council of Churches back in the 40s, their interdenominational Bureau of Church Architecture, could only serve warmed-over medievalisms of the Anglo-Catholic ecclesiologists of a century before. And they bemoan high churchmen seeking for a dramatic worship experience performed in the awe and mystery of the deep medieval chancel. Third example, James Hastings Nichols, the author of two studies of the Mercersburg theology, wrote a study for the Presbytery of Chicago in 1960, and he too laments the cult of the Gothic revival, which, he says, in the last two generations has established the opinion very widely that Gothic is the normal and correct pattern for a church, even a Presbyterian church. And they argue, he and Leonard Trinterud argue, a return to Reformed principles of church architecture. Point C, final point on the outline. And what of the future? Reformed architecture and a sense of awe. Well, from the standpoint that we've just looked at of Reformed modernism, it looks like Santee Chapel and its Richardsonian building are consigned to the dustbin of history, and that it is at best a Catholic, not a Reformed space. Or is it? Looking back from the perspective of 1999 to the 50s and 60s, when these people were writing, I must admit that they had a point. The Gothic revival in the 40s was, in many ways, exhausted. It was often just a habit to have a split chancel, an altar, pulpit, and lectern separate. It was not thoughtfully done. And it often prevented people from thinking creatively about Reformed worship space. And so I am grateful for the revival of the Reform of the simple tradition in architectural modernism, and grateful, too, for its revitalization of a sense of worship space reflecting some important Reformed values: the full participation of God's people in worship, an avoidance of aestheticism or ritualism or clericalism, and at its best, a careful regard for word and sacrament. But I wonder if this fascination with architectural modernism of the last several decades, linked with a narrow definition of Reformed architecture as a simple tradition, does not miss some lessons we can learn from the liturgical tradition of Mercersburg, with its concern for liturgy, its concern with, in some sense, sacred space, its concern with beauty, including the place of visual art in the sanctuary. Now, surely we don't want to go back to Gothic or Romanesque per se, but from the standpoint of the end of our century, and dare I say it, a postmodernism that can recover a sense of particular traditions within the Reformed family, the concept of Reformed architecture needs to be defined more broadly than has been the tendency since the 50s and 60s. And here, Mercersburg and your chapel can teach, I think, all the Reformed communion some lessons. For I suggest to you today that the problem is not so much a shop-worn Gothic revival as it is a loss of the sense of God's transcendence and a loss of sense of awe before God in worship. Indeed, I fear that the simple tradition of Reformed architecture has lately been in danger of losing any sense of God's transcendence, of beauty, or the need for awe in Christian worship. The old Reformed conviction that the church is not a house of God, but a house of the people, has degenerated into a sense that this is just our house. Pardon the darkness of that slide. It's taken at dusk. This is McKinney Memorial Bible Church, a mile from my home in Fort Worth. It's a good example, I think, of this loss of transcendence in worship space. This church admirably fulfills its function. It is a ranch-style home, basically, welcoming to the visitor, who, as you drive up, is sheltered under a porte cochere, in case it's raining, and goes through a door that looks just like the front door of any home in the area. And indeed, the roof line, and I'm sorry you can't see this more clearly, the roof line reflects precisely the roof lines of the houses surrounding it in the neighborhood. This is a church that is in many ways admirable, I think. It's very well done, but it's also wonderfully user-friendly. But taken to its extreme, I'm afraid that user-friendly churches spell the death of sacred space. Ken Seide, writing in an article in Christianity Today a few years ago, quotes an architect and consultant named Ray Bowman, who says this. He says, "Ecclesiastical architecture that says we are building a building to honor God, to embody God, is off base." Bowman points to the Gothic style of many cathedrals as an example, with its massive ornate forms and tall vertical spaces. It may be in scale with God, but it's out of scale with human beings. Instead, Bowman promotes a ministering center. And such a center can be used for corporate worship one day, a luncheon the next, and a basketball game that evening. In short, the myth of sacred space, a place devoted exclusively to worship, stands in the way of ministry, he says. Was Bowman right? My friend Don Saliers, who teaches at Candler School of Theology at Emory, has written eloquently about the loss of a sense of awe in worship. Recently, Don writes, following a Sunday service in a Protestant church of some 900 members, I overheard a worshiper say to her companion, "Whatever happened to awe?" Saliers continues, "The plain fact is that much of our worship in contemporary American churches, Protestant, Roman Catholic alike, is domesticated. It's pleasant, even user-friendly, but something is missing at the heart of our practices as well as our theology. Awe in the presence of God." What all Reformed Christians can learn, I think, from your German Reformed tradition, the tradition represented here in this chapel, is not that there should be some kind of Reformed Gothic revival, Romanesque revival. Rather, the question is, does our architecture and our worship space nurture a Reformed sense of awe before the presence of God? What Mercersburg and its heritage, including Santee Chapel, can contribute to all of us today, I think, is a new sense of some central Reformed interests, a sense of awe before God's greatness and transcendence, a sense of the centrality of Christ's incarnational presence to the community in word and sacrament, a sense of the church as Christ's body, a sense of liturgy and worship as devotion to God that also leads directly to service outside these walls, and finally, a sense of beauty, beauty as an apt and fitting response to the greatness and the goodness of God. My hope for you in the season of rededication of this worship space is that you may continue in your tradition, looking to the past not with nostalgia, but building on the past for the future of your work and your ministry in this place. Thank you very much.